We've got a strange relationship to speed cameras as the British, I think, if you'll excuse me for generalising as a minute. Has ever struck you as a bit strange how that we all agree as we take our licences and do our provisional tests and get our licences and we read the highway code, that we all on some level sign up to agreeing that the rules of the road. So we all know that the rules are that on a motorway or dual carriageway we can go
72 miles an hour.
Thank you. In the village we can go
30.
And now up Lobmore Lane and behind we can go
20.
Does anyone do that? I mean, we all do that, thank you. Yeah, very important around here, the Hildens. The potholes, mainly, absolutely. But so we all agree to this on some level, and yet we can't have speed cameras unless they are bright yellow and they are signposted left, right, and centre. Has it ever struck you as odd that we're not sneakier at trying to catch people out? Why is it that we have this strange sense of fair play, that we have to make them as visible as possible, to the point that if a speed camera is out of use, we put a sign on it saying, this speed camera is not in use. In other words, giving you permission to speed, it's all about as long as you're not caught out, it's okay. That can't be what we mean, is it? In this series, we're going to be looking at this idea of covenants. And in the story of scripture, covenants, we'll come on to what that means in a moment, but the agreements are made between God and humankind about who we are as human beings and how we relate to the world around us. It's there written in black and white what our purpose is and how we are to live and to be and to interact with one another. And yet humankind, throughout our history, in every nation and people and tribe and moment in time, seem to be surprised when we're caught out by things not being how we expect them to be. Now, some of us may have a view of God that he's just maliciously waiting like a speed camera, hiding round the corner, waiting to catch us out when we do something wrong. And that is not what God is like, and that is not what covenant is about. It's a far, far better, more exciting story than that. But we'll come back to speed cameras later on, because I want to ask you this question. Why? My children love this question. I think all children love this question. It's a good question. It's the right question to ask. But why do you think you exist as a human being? What is your raison d'etre? What is your reason for being? If you believe in God like I do, why do you think he created you? Don't say that we don't ask the big questions at Holy Trinity West, God. Why do you exist? Why did God make you? Was it because he was bored and had nothing better to do? Was it a strange drunken bet that he could make something more peculiar than the duck-billed platypus? Was it that he actually needed you as a kind of early labour-saving device, like a tea maid, to kind of work the land and do the stuff he couldn't be bothered to do? Did he make you kind of, because he's got a kind of divine ego that needs meeting, that he needs these little people running around singing choruses over and over again to kind of stroke his divine being and say, there, there. Why is it that you were made? Have you ever stopped and thought about this question? Because how you answer it will define everything you do in life, whether you answer it consciously and with intentionality, or whether you kind of sleepwalk into why you live and what you live for. Because the biblical picture we get in this idea of covenant is that you weren't created for any of those reasons I mentioned earlier. You weren't created to give vague sentimental feelings in your private life to some divine being either. You were made, yes, you, with your particular collection of atoms and skills and abilities and experiences, you were made to partner with God for the sake of the cosmos. That's quite impressive, right? You were made to partner with the creator of the universe, with him, for the benefit of the whole of creation, for the benefit of the rest of humanity, for the benefit of the planet, of people, for communities. You were made for eternity. You were made for partnership. And you were made for relationship. You are made to work with God. And we talk about having a relationship with God, and it can sound quite soppy and sentimental. If you've ever sat in church going, why are we singing love songs to Jesus? That's not really my cup of tea. There's nothing wrong with that. But this is a kind of love which involves meaningful relationship, that God is putting his trust in you. He's recognizing you and saying, I want to come alongside you and care about the things you care about it, and allow you to care about the things that he cares about, so that bit by bit the world may become a more beautiful place than it was intended to be. And the biblical word for this partnership relationship could be translated as alliance or a treaty, or the biblical word we use is this idea of covenant. And it's this idea of what is it to partner with God in covenant that we're going to be unpacking over the next 6 weeks. And I don't want to oversell, but how we understand this will define how we live and who we are. So these are big questions as we sweep through the biblical story. So big, I'm going to throw my clicker in surprise. The closest analogy, perhaps, to covenant that we have in our culture, because the ancient ways of doing covenant are ancient and peculiar to us, is the idea of marriage, of a good marriage, where two people come alongside each other in equal partnership, distinct individuals, and yet equally partnered together for a shared purpose of doing life in a new way. That is the closest we come, perhaps, in our contemporary understanding of what covenant is. But back to this question of why and what your purpose is, because this isn't a new question to be asking. And people in the ancient Near East, the region where the Israelites were operating in, had all sorts of different ways about answering why they were created, why human beings came into existence. And I can't begin to do justice to just how radical the biblical vision is for why you exist. It is extraordinary. And of course, with a few thousand years history and these stories being so parodied in our DNA, that we think, of course, Adam and Eve, blah, 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 a weird story, snake. The claims it is making about life is so radical and mind-boggling. It shakes the foundations of humanity's previous understanding of itself. So let me very quickly mention the biblical story of Adam and Eve, which we'll come on to in a minute. But before we come to this overly familiar and perhaps overly simplified and cheapened story, let me just mention a few of the other ways that people understood the world, because here's a list of stories. I'm not going to read them all to you, but ancient stories people told in the region where Judaism sprang up, the Israelites found their way and encountered God through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And these are some of the ancient stories we have all of or part of that are accounts of why the world was created. They make interesting reading. The Gilgamesh is a brilliant, wacky, gruesome, horrible story. The Sumerian flood tablet needs a rebranding, but it's a story of the account of a flood sweeping the ancient world. Sound familiar? The Sumerian list of kings is very similar to some of the lists of people we've got in the Old Testament. But the one I want to quickly tell you, very briefly, and if you want the full gruesome version, then I come to the pub on Wednesday night and we can have a bit more of a gruesome ancient story time. But the Atrahasis epic, it tells an account for why people were created. And this is helpful because this is far closer to people's understanding about why they existed in relation to the gods than anything we have in contemporary society. So in the Atrahasis epic, you have the senior gods, and they kind of accidentally stumble across the cosmos and make it in a slightly clumsy way. But then they decide they're getting hungry and need to get some food. So then they create all the lesser gods to kind of essentially to till the fields and you know, cook the bacon and whatever else they're doing. So they get on doing that for a while. But then after a bit, the lesser gods get a bit grumpy about having to do all this manual labor. And they essentially go on strike. A very contemporary theme, of course, today. So that they go on strike and refuse to do any work. So that the negotiations take place. They get the trade union of the gods across the table. And they say, look, why don't we make some beings whose whole purpose is to make food for the gods? And they agree to this. They make seven males and seven female human beings, who are these useful slaves who then make food. And that all goes along fairly well, and everyone's happy for a bit. But then the problem is that the people keep breeding. And before too long, there are so many people across the land that the gods find they're being so noisy, they can't focus on their crosswords. I slightly altered the meaning there. So essentially, that they're so noisy, the gods are like, we can't cope with all this noise. What can we do to reduce the noise? I've got a good sensible solution, which is very bureaucratic. You might recognize this. We'll just wipe them all out and move on and go back to what we were doing before. So the gods decide to wipe humanity out. And then various amazing events come, and one human being survives with his partner, and they breathe a new human race, and they kind of come to negotiation. Now, in this story, in almost all ancient stories about creation, the gods come across as petty, unpleasant, unpredictable, and nasty, like the nightmare neighbor next door. They also come across as kind of fairly powerless, really. They accidentally create things or make mistakes. That there's a lack of awesomeness to them. They're very, very human or even subhuman in how they act in their pettiness. And people are made not for relationship or for a purpose, but simply to provide food. Or in some ancient accounts, we're made by accident from the snot of a great being, or something. That one's not actually a real one, but you know the kind of thing. We're a mistake, or we're made for food, and we're kind of an afterthought to the gods, but we're not an integral part of what they're trying to do. They don't really care about us unless we're being so noisy, or they need us to bring them their dinner. That is the ancient understanding of how we relate to creation as human beings. It's like the gods, if there are any, are there just to catch us out and to sneak up on us and to be malicious and but the problem is, unlike the laws of the road, where we all know what speed we should go on a dual carriageway, well done, and just good to check, it's a public safety briefing, but the rules keep changing, so humanity never know how they stand in relation to the gods and the cosmos. How different that is to the biblical narrative about why you, yes, you, were made by God. So just very quickly, because we're already overrunning today, here are four reasons the biblical story makes a radical point about why you're made. And again, on Wednesday, we can explore, what is this story? Is it true? Is it myth? Is it deeper than that? What do we make of it? Because I know people have questions about that. But here are four radical points it makes about why you exist. And it's these I want you to hold on to. The first one, in the beginning of the reading that Jan brought to us, God doesn't need us. He didn't need us to make him dinner. He didn't need us to do some task. He made us because he wanted us. You are wanted. Did you hear that? God didn't make you because he needs you. He made you because he wanted you. You are the overflow of God's heart that is made for relationship, and he made you because he longs for you and he wants the best for us as people. God doesn't need us. He wants us. You're the product of desire. You're the product of love. And that changes everything. And if you hear nothing else today, and you've grown up in a lie whereby maybe it's been deeply drilled into you from a childhood that you're not really worth anything and you don't matter, and you have to earn your way in the world and you have to earn the love of your Heavenly Father, then no, that's not why God made you. You are made for love. Secondly, whereas in many of the ancient stories in the ancient world, the gods need people to make food for them. In the garden, we see God provide this beautiful world, the Garden of Eden, this safe place where people can explore and work out who they are, where they can relate to the world around them, and where there is abundant food for abundant life, so that they are free to explore more of their creative potential. God provides for humanity, and the world is a gift to us to enjoy and be a part of. Thirdly, he has made you for meaningful work in partnership with him. God created Adam. The word means humanity. This kind of Adam stands in place for all of us, to work alongside him. If you ever wonder what church has to do, what faith has to do with reality, the worlds of business and finance and law and commerce and real stuff, God made us to partner with him, to do those things in the way that he wants us to operate as human beings, with justice and mercy and hope and love and creativity and compassion. He made you with all the gifts you have to use them for the good of the world, to do meaningful work, but not in isolation, in partnership with him. God is interested in your day-to-day life and what you do, whether that's the life in home, whether that's life in your hobbies, whether that's life in retirement, what that looks like for you, whether that's life in your work and labor. God is interested in you. He made you to work in partnership. And finally, we weren't made to just work the land and to be in some kind of vague breeding program to create more laborers. We were made to be in relationship with God, with the planet that we're to partner with, and to be in partnership with one another. So God makes Eve, whose name means life, from man, distinct and yet individual and yet beautiful, in partnership with Adam, the human being. We are made to be in relationship with one another. And marriage is one picture of that, and it's a beautiful picture, but it's more general than that. We are made as relational beings. We are made to speak peace into our communities, to be hope bringers. God is interested in the details of how you relate to other people, for he has made us for relationship. And if that all sounds blindingly obvious to you, it's because this story is now written on our cultural DNA, but this is not normally how people have interpreted how they relate to the gods and the planet. This was radical, and it is radical. And one of the things I recognize in a post-Christian generation now, who are struggling to find hope and meaning and purpose, is they are resorting to old mythological ideas that they are bad news for the planet, that they are just a drain on society, that the only way to enjoy the short time they have alive is to perhaps make the most of it, or perhaps it's just to be so fearful that you're going to damage the planet that you retreat into a ball, or you're scared of relationship because relationships are complex and it's easier to sit and stare at your phone. In some ways, our culture is reverting to these old ancient myths about how we relate to the gods and the planet and the world. And so this promise of a God who's interested in covenant, in partnership with us for the sake of the cosmos, is better news now than perhaps it's ever been before. And it's this story, as it unfolds in human history, we're going to unpack in the coming weeks. Of course, we all know the story doesn't end well in the garden. And Adam and Eve's story of turning away from God's plan for partnership with him and going their own way is each of our stories. And each of us will have our stories about the ways we've gone astray and the ways we've walked away from God and made a mess of things and had to come back to him. And the rest of this idea of covenant in the scriptures, in many ways, is going to be exploring how God is not going to give up on partnering with us on that vision of why we were created. And it's all going to come back to the cross. In our New Testament reading, we heard about how Paul talks about Jesus being the second Adam, the new coming of humanity, being human beings as we were always meant to be. If you want to know what we are meant to look like as people living a full life, look at Jesus, who he was and how he lived. That's life in all its fullness. Not easy or straightforward, but transformative to the world around him, bringing life and hope wherever he goes. And John Henry Newman penned these words in a great old hymn, which sums up what Jesus did and why. O loving wisdom of our God, when all was sin and shame, a second Adam to the fight and to the rescue came. That's the message of Easter. Pause for a moment. Close your eyes. Just in 30 seconds silence, why don't you ask God, ask the Holy Spirit to be with you as you think about your life at the moment. And why don't you picture your work, whether work's in your household or the workplace or whatever it looks like for you in its broader sense at the moment. And ask God, what's it look like to meaningfully partner with him for the good of the planet and people at this moment in your life?